In just a moment, we'll be reading from 1 Kings, the third chapter again, where we had our Bible reading earlier. That's page 233 in the Pew Bible, if you'd like to turn there. 1 Kings chapter 3. At some point down the road, this congregation will again go through the formal process of searching out from amongst ourselves leaders, shepherds, elders to help guide and direct this flock. And perhaps the successfulness of that process will be determined not by what we think or do at that moment, but perhaps by what we have thought about before then. That is, I think there's an ongoing process we should all engage in of evaluating the brethren among us and be observing one another, not particularly for criticism, but observing for the point of trying to recognize and identify who possesses leadership qualities among us. So the lessons today, both this morning and tonight, are going to be concerned with elders, either some element of their work or perhaps even the process of searching for them among the group here. So I encourage you to think along and study along with that as a backdrop. There are a number of seeming contradictions to serving as an elder. On the one hand, even as we were just singing, I want to be a worker for the Lord. To serve as an elder, there must be a desire. There must be an inward interest in helping and assisting the people of God in a leadership role. The desire certainly must be founded on the proper principles. But nonetheless, on the other end of the spectrum from the desire is a sense of dread in what comes from that position. A desire to serve and yet a dread of the responsibility, a dread of what is at stake, a dread of the importance that hangs on certain decisions that are made and how certain situations are handled. And so there's seemingly a contradiction to be desiring something that you may dread in a righteous way at the same time. There's also a sort of a contradiction in serving as an elder in that on the one hand, there's authority invested in that particular role, the power and the right to make certain judgments for the good of the congregation, to help them grow and to keep them on the right track spiritually. But on the other end of the spectrum, apart from the authority, it's a serving role. And that's really what I want to concentrate on in the lesson this morning, the servant leadership of the elders. The authority is certainly not given to elders for themselves. It's not given to them for aggrandizement of who they are or to make their life a little more happy because they can make certain decisions. But the role itself and the function of elders is a servant leadership position, to serve the people of God by leading them. And that sort of sounds like a contradiction when you first think of it. But I want to look at three examples that don't specifically have anything to do with elders, but they do have to do with leaders. And three examples that might help us understand the importance of leading the people of God while serving them at the same time and being sensitive to the needs of God's people. In 1 Kings chapter 3, we were reading about Solomon. And after David had died and the reins of government were turned over to Solomon by God's decree, Solomon began to reflect on the weight that was now upon him, the responsibility that he had to govern and govern well the people of God. As we read in the passage, an offer is made by God to Solomon concerning what he would want. And before we talk about Solomon, let's just look again at verse 5 and notice the principle of servant leadership in God Himself. Now, God obviously has all authority, and He is the Creator, and everything happens by His design and His purpose. And yet, at Gibeon in verse 5, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" There's the God of all creation, the God of all eternity, saying to a human being, what do you want, Solomon? What can I do for you, Solomon? And so even here in the example of God, you have something of servant leadership. God is the ultimate leader, but He says to Solomon, what can I give you? How can I help you? In verses 6 and 7, as Solomon reflects on the responsibility that's now his, he's humbled by it. He's not inflated by it. He does not now begin to focus on himself and to realize, hey, this is pretty neat. I have rule. I have leadership. I have royal prerogative. No, quite the opposite, in fact. Solomon seems overwhelmed with his inadequacy. Solomon says, you have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, verse 6. Because he walked before you in truth and righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you've given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. That's Solomon's commentary on God's servant leadership. Look what you've done for my father David. Now, O Lord, my God, verse 7, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. That's a Hebrew way of saying, I really don't know how to go about this. Going out and coming in simply refers to a man going through the normal course of his life. Going out of his tent and coming into his tent, going out to do business and make decisions and coming in afterward. Solomon says, I don't know how to really conduct myself in this office. And that's interesting because he had had a model in his own father. But as we think about elders, or we think about becoming an elder, which is what those who are the male children of God should at some point in their lives at least be evaluating themselves in regard to, whether they come to a negative or a positive answer. But we might want to stop and think about the overwhelming responsibility that it is and the smallness that we might feel within ourselves to be in this position. No, we're not talking about a king in being an elder, but nonetheless one of a leadership role. And Solomon says, I'm a little child. I realize what is at stake here, and I realize perhaps in a more magnified way now that I'm considering seriously this role, I realize how many mistakes I've made, how many errors of judgment I've made. I feel my smallness before this great responsibility to help lead the people of God. And because Solomon felt that, what he asked for was not something to please himself or satisfy himself. He understood what was at stake. And what he asks for is greater capacity to lead well. In verse 8, and your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. As an elder, I think probably our elders might feel that way. Three men ruling over a congregation of this size. This is too numerous a congregation for me to adequately rule. But Solomon looked out over the multitudes of God's people and understood all of the disagreements and all of the civil problems among the people. And let me say this before I talk about Solomon's attitude toward the people of God. Solomon knew the history of these people. He had seen his own father be rebelled against by a half-brother at that. But even though we call this period of time historically the United Kingdom, it wasn't always united in spirit. It may have been united geographically. But David had all kinds of unrest within, and there were challenges to his leadership, even in the initial stages after Saul was dead. David ruled in Hebron for 7 years before he could get a consensus of all of the people of Israel to acknowledge him as one, as king. All had not been hunky-dory, and Solomon had seen that. And yet, look at his attitude again in verse 8. And your servant, that's himself, your servant, not your illustrious king, your servant is in the midst of your people whom you've chosen, a great people too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? Solomon's great desire was to rule and to serve in a leadership position effectively, and do so with wisdom and understanding, because these were the people of God. It wasn't about him. It was about them. These are your people. How do I adequately serve them by ruling over them? Well, a lot more could be said of interest there, but let's turn to the book of Nehemiah and notice another example of servant leadership. I guess I should have shown you Solomon there. Nehemiah chapter 5. This is much later in the history of the Israelite people. After Solomon's rule, the nation divided into a northern and southern kingdom, both kingdoms, north and south, eventually declining and being taken off by God into captivity to their enemies, as God had said it would be if they became unfaithful. But over the course of time, there was enough godliness among the captives that had been scattered that they came back to God in their hearts. They repented, and God had said, if you do this, I'll bring you back to the land. I'll reconstitute you as a nation, which is a phenomenal act of the power of God in and of itself. But after they came back into the land, things were not all well from the start. In fact, as we read in Nehemiah 5, we're reading almost 100 years after the people have come back from captivity, and the walls around the city are still broken down. That is, they are vulnerable. They're basically defenseless to their enemies. And they're not the self-governing and self-ruling people that they wish to be and God would have them to be. And so Nehemiah is a Jew living still in the land of captivity. And he has a very high position. He's a cupbearer to the king, a very trusted position, the one who tastes the wine to make sure it's not poisoned. Thus, you better trust your wine taster. And so Nehemiah has this high position, and he becomes aware of things not being well at home, and there's unfinished work to be done. And so Nehemiah wishes to return to the land and do what he can to help put the nation back in order. And this he does by going back and rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. Not himself, but as a leader gathering the people to attend to the work that needed to be done. What I want you to notice in this story, and again, there's much worthy of consideration here, but I want to notice in Nehemiah 5, beginning in verse 14, what Nehemiah's attitude was toward his leadership role over the people. Nehemiah 5 and verse 14. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. But the former governors who had been before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. Indeed, I also continued the work on this wall, and we did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 Jews and rulers, besides those who came to us from the nations around us. Now that which was prepared for me daily was one ox and six choice sheep, Also, fowl were prepared for me, and once every 10 days, an abundance of all kinds of wine. Yet in spite of this, I did not demand the governor's provisions, because the bondage was heavy on this people. Remember me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. We could add, for this people of yours. Nehemiah, like Solomon before him, strongly felt a sense of responsibility to rule over the people of God and not to see that role as something to draw attention to themselves or not some sort of privilege unto themselves. And what Nehemiah is saying here is, I made a point to conduct myself differently than previous governors before me who saw the office as being a way to gather for themselves. And so he says, I didn't take the governor's provision. And these former governors even had their servants ruling, and I take it to be heavy-handedly, over the people. And Nehemiah said, my servants were here to work. And Nehemiah said, I was here to work. I wasn't here to buy land. He says, we didn't buy up all the choice parcels of land. I didn't tax the people. I didn't take the governor's provisions. I was here among the people of God as a worker. My servants were among the people of God as workers. And in the course of the story, it's interesting to see how quickly they accomplished this gargantuan task of rebuilding the walls. 52 days, it says. But nonetheless, Nehemiah says he governed the people for 12 years because they continued to have need of leadership. And so, in a way, Nehemiah embodies this sense of servant leadership, serving on behalf of the people and for the people and not for the sake of the leader himself. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 6, I neglected to tell you the page on Nehemiah. This is page 795 in the Pew Bible, if you're using that. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 6 through 11. Turning from a king and a governor now to an apostle, Paul talks about himself among the Thessalonians. And some of these same characteristics, I think, of servant leadership can be seen in the apostle Paul. And his concern for the people he rules over, not for himself as a leader in some capacity drawing attention to himself. But it's interesting to see even the tenderness that he speaks of here relative to his authoritative role among the Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, let's read verses 6 through 11. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others, when we might have made demands as apostles of Christ. Stop right there. That sort of sounds like Nehemiah, doesn't it? I could have made a demand as the governor to have the governor's salary and income. Paul said, I could have made certain demands as an apostle by virtue of the authority, but he said, we didn't do that. Rulers of God's people don't wield authority for their own sake. That seems to be a common characteristic of those who understood servant leadership. Verse 7, but we were gentle among you, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children. So now look at the analogy he draws. What Curtis described very well, I think, for those of us that are parents, the sacrifice and even the suffering at times that comes in the earlier days of being a parent, and the child knows nothing, it can't speak, it knows nothing but, wah! And that can mean I'm hungry, or I'm dirty, or I'm tired, put me down, leave me alone, pick me up, comfort me. And as a nursing mother cares for her child, she learns quickly, and non-nursing dads, it's not about mom and dad. It's about the child. All of the physical power and all the authority that comes of being a parent, all that's directed toward caring for and providing for the child. It's not about, I'm the dad, you stop crying. That doesn't work with a baby. So you channel whatever power or authority or wisdom or lack thereof, but what you have, you channel toward the care of the infant because it's about them. It isn't about you anymore, dad. And it isn't about you anymore, mom. It's about the baby. and nurturing and caring for the baby. That's what Paul says. This is how I viewed my apostleship when I was among you. Verse 8. So affectionately longing for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you had become dear to us. For you remember, brethren, our labor and toil, for laboring night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you, we preach to you the gospel of God. Okay, stop again there. Doesn't verse 9 sound like Nehemiah? I came here to work. My servants came here to work. Paul says, you remember our labor and toil, laboring night and day to support ourselves that we might, when we weren't working, preach to you. Paul understood that leadership was about working. Leadership was not about being served, but serving. And it was about the people of God and what they needed. Verse 10, you're witnesses, and God also, how devoutly and justly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe, as you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you. Now he sort of changes the figure. As a father does his own children. That you would have a walk worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. Back in verse 6, Paul said, we did not seek glory from men. What I'm about to say has no reflection on our elders presently. I think they're exactly the opposite of this characteristic. Any man that seeks the eldership for the glory and the title and the position, or so he can go to a gospel meeting somewhere and say, I'm an elder at the Ember Hills Church, doesn't get it. You don't get it. It isn't about being seen as being an elder of the Ember Hills Church. It is about serving. It is not about glory being accumulated unto oneself. It is about what can I do for the people of God. This reflects what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 20, verses 25 and 26. He was talking there about characteristics of true leadership, spiritual leadership, because his apostles were arguing amongst themselves. Which of them would have the glory? Which of them would have the position of leadership? Jesus says, Matthew 20, verses 25 and 26, but Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over him. Now stop right there. If you studied first century history, you know what this desire to lord it over others led to among the Herods and among the Caesars and among other lesser authorities in the Roman government. It was dog eat dog, cut throat, stab each other in the back, do whatever it took to get ahead, to trample the other guy underfoot. And Jesus knew the same thing would be true in his church if leaders desired the position to lead for themselves. And so he's pointing out here to political leadership in the Gentile world and saying, you see that? That is not what it's about in leading my people. It is not about the position, and it's not about the title, and it's not about being served. He goes on and says, yet it shall not be so among you, verse 26, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And he says desire to be great, I think, advisedly. He's not saying, well, it's a wonderful thing if you desire to be great. Just make sure you serve people. He's speaking accommodatively. I referred at the beginning of the lesson to the desire to be an elder. The desire, but then the dread at the same time. If you desire to lead, if you desire to serve the Lord in your fullest capacity, understand it's about serving. And it's not about the server. It's not about political plays. And it's not about one's own personal glory. But it's about the people and what can be done for them. Back in 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 8, Paul says, we imparted not only to you the gospel, but our own lives. Chapter 2 and verse 8, our own lives. I think that's something else that's fundamental to understanding servant leadership. It's not just about punching a clock, or it's not just about doing the minimum but it's about giving one's life. It's about being devoted, body and soul, to the point sometimes of mental or emotional exhaustion or physical exhaustion. And oftentimes an elder will be in the situation of Paul, having to support themselves secularly while doing spiritual work in the off time. That is a grueling schedule, emotionally and mentally and physically. And yet Paul said, we gave our very lives for you. In 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 15, he talked about the desire to spend and be spent for the Corinthians. Spend whatever he had to spend and be spent internally, be spent for the people of God. Then he also said in verses 10 and 11, as we were reading, he said our character was unimpeachable. And of course, this begins to bleed into the very qualifications in Timothy and Titus as we begin to search for elders among us, the idea of being blameless. Paul says, we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his children. Your witnesses in verse 10, how devoutly and justly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you. I tell you, it takes a pretty clear conscience to be able to just assert before the people who know you, this is what I am. Because you're opening yourselves up to those people going, oh no, you're not. But he says this, he expresses himself confidently because he knows this is what he is. I know this is what I am. I know these are my motives. And I'll say one thing, I would think, I'm not an elder, but about the process of thinking about being an elder, whoever it may be, we're certainly going to be challenged in that moment to think about what we really think about ourselves. What do I really think about myself? What do you really think about yourself? How do you assess your inner qualities? Who do you know yourself to be? That's going to be challenged if the day comes for you to be considered as a leader among God's people. And Paul speaks confidently about who he considers himself to be. First of all, as we've said, it's about the sheep. It's not about the leader or his position. God's people, leaders, always understood, if they were effective, that it was about serving God's people. That's what was paramount. People aren't always easy to lead. Moses found that out. David found that out. The Apostle Paul dealt with it constantly. God's people sometimes can be very, very difficult because they are people and because they have flaws and weaknesses. And the challenge is great to be able to continue to love and serve the people of God when at times, at least by their projected characteristics, they might not be very lovable. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, and I'll come back to this passage tonight, but Moses, in appointing leadership to help him over in his leadership over the people of Israel, spoke about the judgment being God's, the importance of the people to help him at that time, the elders of the people to rule well because of the judgment is God's. It's not about an elder exercising his personal judgment, but the judgment is God's. It's implementing the law of God among the people of God to help promote spiritual growth and development. And so again, it's not about the sheep. I mean, it is about the sheep. It's not about the shepherd. It's not about the position. It's about the people. Turning back in the New Testament to John chapter 10. It's about the sheep, but it's about knowing them as individuals with talents, needs, and weaknesses. And in John 10, Jesus is talking about his relationship with his people. But nonetheless, I don't think it's accidental that he, in referring to himself as the great shepherd of the sheep, uses that same terminology to talk about elders. They are shepherds, or if you will, under-shepherds, under his authority and rule. but nonetheless patterned after, to some degree, the great shepherd. And Peter even uses that sort of terminology in 1 Peter chapter 5. But notice in verse 3 of chapter 10, Gospel of John, "To him," that is the shepherd of the sheep, "the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out." In verse 4, "When he brings out his own sheep, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice." The idea here is of Jesus knowing his people individually. He's not just the shepherd over the flock, but he's the shepherd over the individual sheep. And the challenge, I think, of elders, one of the challenges, is to understand that they rule not only over the group, but they are shepherds of individual lives. And to do that well, there must be an understanding of the sheep. There must be an understanding of people regarding their talents and where to place them so that the body functions in the best possible way. Their needs. And that can be very difficult because we're becoming very good in our society at covering up our needs and our weaknesses. We don't necessarily want people to see that. So sometimes we sort of play a part and we project what we want to project and we conceal the rest. The challenge of elders is to understand what are the true needs of the individuals over whom they shepherd. Their weaknesses. What do I see in this person? What do I see in that person? Have they demonstrated in one way or another a need that might be supplied either by us as shepherds or by someone else in the congregation able to guide them and lead them as a spiritual person? I'm going to develop this point a little bit more tonight, but you notice in verse 4 of chapter 10, not only does the shepherd know the sheep, but the sheep know the shepherd. And so this is a reciprocal knowledge and acquaintance, again, that we'll develop more tonight. But the idea here in serving as an elder, it's not just about setting policy. It's not just about getting in a room together and establishing some course of action and then seeing that it's implemented. It's a people position. It's servant leadership, keeping the individual sheep in mind. And communication is extremely vital to that particular process. Well, this familiarity and service as a shepherd, again, it's about the sheep, but it's about loving the sheep, not serving over them merely as a hireling. Chapter 10, verses 12 and 13. "He who is a hireling and not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he's a hireling and does not care about the sheep." Again, if it's about position, that's the wrong frame of mind. It's about, if necessary, giving one's life for the sheep and defending the sheep. And the hireling running here in the story may not be an elder saying, "I don't want to be an elder anymore." But it may be a sort of hiding from issues, not wanting to deal with a certain person or not wanting to deal with a certain situation because we know that's going to be tough. Well, that's what leadership's about. It's about facing tough situations and dealing with complicated issues and sometimes dealing with complicated people. And if anybody could do it, I suppose the qualifications wouldn't be as stringent as they are in 1 Timothy 3 and in Titus. The rule and leadership of the people of God is vitally important. I said in a sermon a few weeks ago, the backbone of a local church is not the eldership, and I think that's right. The backbone in terms of the functioning of the local church, the things that are going to get done, the teaching that's going to be done, the elders can't be the backbone. There aren't enough of them to go around. The work is too great for any limited number of men. We all have to be involved in this process. Nonetheless, the role of leading the people of God is vitally important. And men who are put in the position of so leading and discover only afterwards that they're not qualified, or the brethren discover afterwards that they weren't qualified, can be extremely damaging to a local church. And in fact, as time goes on, it seems like you hear more and more stories of men from the role of being an elder involved in things they shouldn't be and doing great harm to the people of God. It's a crucial, vital role. It's not the backbone in that sense, but it's crucial to the well-functioning of any local church. And thus, the Lord makes provision for that. It's a wonderful thing to aspire to, but those who undertake the role must go in with their eyes wide open and understanding what is involved in serving the people of God by leading them. If you're not a child of God, we've been talking about issues that don't really have to do with obeying the gospel, but I will make this point. We've been talking about a portion of God's provision for us that we can reach spiritual maturity. God has done so many wonderful things for us, provided so many good things, even elders in a local church, to help us get to heaven. But none of that avails unless we take the first steps, unless we respond to the invitation of the Lord to come to Him to start with. And so, if you're tired of living a life of guilt and perhaps emptiness, a sense of not having a real lasting purpose in this world, and you realize that on your own, it's hopeless. We were singing about that just a few moments ago. What are we going to bring to God to atone for our sins? Our work, our effort, our tears? The only thing that can atone is the blood of Christ, and that's offered to you today. It's offered to you every moment of every day, but it's up to you to reach out and take advantage of it. Can we help you do that, even while we stand and sing?